From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in 2009 when a young architect named Amy Swift was laid off from her New York City firm. And so she moved home to Detroit to finish her master's degree and bought a house. You know the kind of house, great potential, real character, some history, but needs a lot of work. And the problem was Amy couldn't find anyone to work on the windows. So she took a contractor training course and did it herself. And that kind of lit a fire. In 2012, Amy created Building Hugger in an effort to create skilled jobs and provide more accessible preservation trade services. By 2016, Building Hugger had a staff of 14, about two-thirds women. They've restored, well, more than 1,000 windows last year alone and are building a hardware store to offer homeowners better fixtures and resources for renovating old homes. A piece in Glamour magazine said about her, quote, "Everyone told Amy Swift that construction work was a man's job. So she started her own company and proved them all wrong," end quote. Today, Amy Swift is in Rochester as a guest of the Landmark Society's 2017 New York Statewide Preservation Conference, and it's a timely visit. There are training programs and resources for people who want to work in skilled trades, but there are also questions about tax credits and how the Trump administration views this kind of thing. And if preservation is going to continue to be a priority, we will need crews who understand how to handle the masonry, the carpentry, the windows, and more. Let's go ahead and welcome our guests for the hour. Amy Swift is here, the principal and owner of Building Hugger. Can't wait to talk more about your story. Thank you for being here.
Hi.
Also here is Caitlin Mivas, who's a preservation planner with the Landmark Society of Western New York. Caitlin, welcome back to the program.
Thanks.
Wayne Goodman is the executive director of the Landmark Society of Western New York. Wayne, welcome to you.
Thank you.
And Dan McEnany is a public outreach coordinator for the New York State Division for Historic Preservation. Dan, welcome to you as well.
Thanks for having us.
It's an annual conference here. And Wayne, tell us just a little bit about what's going on over the next few days.
Well, there's a first of all, our conference has been a statewide conference for the past 5 years, and each year it just continues to grow, which we're really pleased with. And we have wonderful partners, including Dan's division in Albany. We have the Preservation League of New York State, which is a partner, and so we'll have about hopefully maybe upwards of close to 400 people in downtown Rochester for the next few days. And the activities are varied. It's a lot of networking, a lot of opportunities for educational sessions. So, and we're pleased to host.
And how did you find Amy?
How did I find Amy? Through Preservation Networks. I saw her story, and I know I personally have been really interested in. I'm always interested in women who are breaking barriers. And so combining that with preservation, I was like, we have got to get this woman here in Rochester.
And here she is. And if you read these interviews, they always like to focus on the fact that Amy weighs, I don't know, maybe 100 pounds. And, you know, men will see you just lugging heavy equipment around and doing all this work.
I certainly get some
looks. You get some looks? Yeah. No, it's a great story. But why don't you take us back to 2009. I mean, did you foresee this interest? Did you have an interest in kind of doing this kind of work at all?
2011 is actually when I moved back from New York to Detroit. And frankly, I mean, I was just applying for new architectural work. It was not a good market to be job hunting in. And, you know, I found myself without work for long enough and really founded Building Hugger out of a necessity. You know, while I can't find a job, I'll make a job. I guess that's the Detroiter in me. I had started as a consulting company. I was doing historic tax credit application work and working with developers to work projects through the city bureaucracy there. And, really an advocate for development in the preservation world. And so what I started to realize was that there really wasn't a lot of skilled tradespeople that were able to do some of this work. And so as Detroit started to gear up and, Detroit's a cool kid again. So I guess
it is. It's such a cool kid.
Yeah, I guess you guys call it the new Brooklyn or something. we like to think we're better than that. but so I kid. It was a hustle. It was a hustle from the start. It was me trying to feed myself. And so I think that, most business owners that are smart business owners start with a business plan and a vision. And I started with a passion and didn't really know how it fit into the market.
But clearly you saw a need.
Yeah. So really, finding, you know, what was a huge hole in what preservation needed to address the market and what is now in many ways an upmarket in Detroit. So we had a waiting list of 100 people deep as of January that wanted estimates from us. So, I mean, there's a huge need. There's a huge demand. The window industry, we work specifically with windows, do historic window restoration. And that's a multi-billion dollar market if you just even look in historic districts in Detroit. That's insane that there's no one there to address this industry and the need. So, it kind of evolved into meeting that need and have learned a lot of things along the way. I did an apprentice with a vet, a veteran of the trades, and I didn't really have a lot of practical experience. I was an architect, and the joke is that architects don't know what they're doing when it comes to specifications. And then contractors are always, saying this architect doesn't know how to specify this, or so it was a lot of learning on the job.
Is that old saw correct about architects, by the way?
It's funny to have been on both sides of this now. Yeah. I think the most important thing is to understand the other side's perspective and be able to work. So actually, that's a benefit that I do have a perspective of an architect, especially when we've done some commercial jobs and we've had to work with spec writers and project teams. And having been on that other side, I'm able to speak and understand the other side, the architectural side, the project, the client side, and express what we need to do in the field in order to, come to a good solution, basically. So,
and for you now, when you look back at what you've had to learn, what was the biggest learning curve for you in this whole process?
Being a business owner. Mm-hmm. the way that so when I took the training, they teach you how to glaze windows, they teach you how to do carpentry repairs around the frames and on the sashes, but they don't really tell you how to structure a bid. They don't tell you how to really, they don't prepare you as an entrepreneur. I've gone through several business training classes as I've grown, it's trial by fire. You learn a lesson when you fail and you lose money. The biggest challenge is that there, as we scale upwards, there are very few examples for me to look at in this particular trade. My people that I can look to are generally smaller shops that have very different overhead. They have very different operating structures and different means of going through estimations and things like that. The way I see it is my competition, what I'm growing into, is to compete with replacement windows, bottom line. That requires customer service, that requires very clear contracts, that requires things that as historic tradespeople in the traditional sense aren't necessarily equipped to deal with. What's been challenging, the most challenging thing is I'm creating an industry. I'm growing and innovating a historic trade into modern times. There's other similar trades that maybe I can look at, but it's a very, in a lot of ways, I'm forging a new way of doing this business.
Amy is the keynoter, and she's going to be presenting on the subject on breaking barriers, reviving pathways to careers in the trade. So probably a lot of what you were discussing right here. What else are you going to talk about?
Yeah, mostly that. Regulations. And one of the things that we've also tripped and stumbled into is how this trade needs to comply with OSHA and EPA regulations concerning lead and other safety issues on site. And so, I mean, those are written for hundreds of different types of trades, many of which are very modern trades. We are, just by the nature of our work, we work with lead paint. And so working to keep not only our employees, but also our clients safe through the work has been an incredible learning curve and business challenge and personnel challenge and, you know, everything else that goes with it. So, I mean, all of these codes are written, like I said, for hundreds of different types of trades. And so we've had to go through and figure out, okay, so how does this really apply to this particular trade? Because, you know, it's written so broadly. How can we apply this and be in compliance? And again, there's very few people to really look to.
How many people work for Building Hugger now?
We're at 12 right now.
12 right now?
But we're hiring. Winter's our slow season, so mm-hmm. we lost a few over the winter months and didn't replace them. So we'll be hiring again for the busy season, which is starting to take off.
And early on, it was you and...
Me and a toolbox.
You and a toolbox.
Yeah.
Do you remember your first jobs?
Yes. It was a friend of mine who had purchased a house in Palmer Park. Or Palmer Woods, and couldn't find anyone to just put glass in his steel casement windows that he had taken the AC units out of. It took him 3 months. Someone had come by and gave him a quote for $17,000 for exterior storm windows, which was not what he wanted. He just wanted glass in his windows. And so he called me desperate and said, "Will you please just put this glass in my windows? Like, fall is coming." And then... You know, I took a selfie hanging out the window and posted it on my on my Building Hugger page, and I haven't stopped getting calls since. It's just been I hired my first that was September of 2014, and I hired my first person in January 2015, and we've been going strong ever since.
Why do you think the interest so much? Just because there's not as many people doing what you do?
Yeah. There are a few onesie-twosies crafts people that they have small operations. So to say that there's nobody would be incorrect. But, you know, they might be, you know, 9 months for them to come out and even give you an estimate, and then it'll take them another 3 months to turn something around, and then you can't get on their calendar for a year. You know, I really see that as a barrier for people. I mean, if I've got a wallside rep knocking on my door and pushing a hard sale at me, and I can't get the historic window guy or gal or whoever to come and even look at my windows, I'm going to feel hard-pressed to make a decision with what I have in front of me, and that's going to be a replacement window. Once those windows are gone, they're gone, you know? We've been working really hard to not only be competitive in a business sense, where we're developing clearer sales and contracting procedures, more streamlined procedures on site with the project or with the field crew. We've developed we call our shop the Hug Factory, and I, you know, again, a Detroiter is looking to, you know, I'm looking to Ford and the way that they had structured through Division of Labor, Scientific Management, to kind of break down the trade into steps. Certainly not as lifeless and devoid of you know, pride. I think once the assembly line came, we kind of lost pride of work. But I, but what it does is it streamlines a certain parts of the trade. And also in developing a compliance program, there we have to test each area, air monitor testing, to see what the exposure of lead is. So we have to move people around based on their exposure. I mean, it's incredibly... Once we understood what the requirements were to comply with all of these regulatory issues, we had to just scale through the process, and you know, all of the overhead and all of the necessary paperwork and all of that stuff. Like we looked at it, and we said, okay, it can either be me in a toolbox again, or we have to continue to grow and figure out a business model where this makes sense.
Well, I want to broaden this conversation now. I should also tell you she's got a great button. Amy Swift is the owner of Building Hugger, and it's Hug Life represent there, Amy. There you go. Hug Life is what the button says there. Now, she comes to us from Detroit, but I think our guests in studio can help us kind of broaden the discussion on this opportunity. And you might remember that in 2016, the Landmark Society, well, they do the annual Five to Revive. We always have a fun conversation with them about choosing five around the region, five usually locations, sites, buildings that are kind of deserving and in need of revival for historic reasons. But one of the five to revive in 2016 was the traditional trades. Well, they came in to talk about it under this program, and the phones blew up. I was amazed at the interest in this from people talking about either their work in the field or the interest they would have for their kids to kind of get into this as a field. So, Amy, I just want to kind of start there. You're probably not surprised. I was surprised when we had all of that interest. But what do you say to young people thinking about careers, maybe not thinking right away about traditional trades, especially in the preservation field? What do you say?
Well, I think back in, you know, when I was in school, when I was in high school, I wanted to take wood shop, and I was told that's for boys, but it was for boys that like didn't do well in school. Like it was for the stupid kids, which, I mean, you have two pathways ultimately that you're generally given as a young person, and one is to go to college, and one is to learn a skill, and there's a stigma that is a very strong cultural stigma that we assign to trades work. And I think that it pushes people away from what they may have been an interest innately. I have an incredible student loan burden. I think that, you know, maybe I could have done well for not having, you know, gone through all of that training to be an architect, if I, you know, had really focused in and said, no, I know I'm a girl and I know I'm a smart girl, but I think that there's a role for me here in the trades. I think it comes with encouraging people or young people to follow what is ultimately a passion. I think that destigmatizing the trades is really critical to that. I know Mike Rowe talks about that and advocates for the destigmatization of the trades. And I mean, the work that we do isn't for, I mean, it's an incredibly challenging field intellectually. I mean,
no doubt about it.
It's
no
like
doubt.
Giant puzzles that we have to put back together, you know? But it is also like a very skilled trade that you hone over time. And a lot of this knowledge is at risk of being lost because we have, you know, some old timers that are retired or retiring very soon. And there hasn't been robust apprenticeship programs that have filled that middle part. So you have some old timers, and then you have younger people that are starting to think about entering the trades. And so we really, it is the time to act is now, to figure out how we can get more people interested in this as a profession. Otherwise, that knowledge will be gone.
And if they have a passion for it, that's one thing. It's intellectually stimulating. Can you make a good living doing it?
I'm working on it, but that's me as a business owner. So I think that, yeah, you absolutely can. I think that the ability to say that there, you have there's it's a challenging game to not just learn a trade and then but then also be a business. And so there's you can make a living at it. The demand is there, right? You just have to figure out how it works for you as a business.
See, the hard thing for Amy was there are no other companies that she could have gone to work for. You had
right.
to do it yourself.
Right. And so I really see Building Hugger. Yeah. I mean, we're not only scaling locally in Detroit, but we're starting to look at regional models where we can start to go out and train installers and people that, like, we get calls in Flint, we get calls in Toledo. I'm pricing a few jobs out here in Buffalo.
Wow.
And, you know, I think that it's important for a larger company to be able to provide employment. Employment is critical because you can train people all day long. If you're gonna and even if you give them business skills, if you train them, not everyone's cut out for it. So I think that it's important to plug in the skills side of things and generating the demand for people to want to do this kind of work. But I think it's also incredibly important to cultivate the business angle, and to, you know, work with companies that are able to offer employment to these people.
You're hearing Amy Swift, who is the owner of Building Hugger in Detroit. She's in Rochester for the 2017 New York Statewide Preservation Conference. It's going on over the next few days. And let me turn to Dan McEnany, who's the public outreach coordinator for the New York State Division of Historic Preservation, because, you know, our listeners may be hearing Amy not only tell her story, but talk about careers in the trades, and they may wonder about availability of classes and training. And Dan, I know the State Historic Preservation Office has created a series of classes in the traditional trades. What do you want people to know about that?
We have. I should start by saying that Amy and I should have talked a long time ago, because she touched on so many things.
She stole all your thunder there?
Well, no, not my thunder. The things I had to work on, like environmental engineering and learning about taking air samples and lead swipes, learning that we can't just teach people how to repair a window or do historic masonry. We have to teach them also business skills. This came to us during our 2015-20 state plan. The National Park Service requires us to do one every 5 years. Sort of being victims of our own success, we've been promoting a great tax credit program to rehabilitate homeowner buildings and commercial buildings. So when we started the planning process, we heard back from so many people, it's great that you're promoting this. There's incentives out there. There's no one to do the work. Which got us thinking about the traditional trades, talking to and doing outreach with a lot of craftspeople who are saying, I'm not taking on apprentices anymore. It's too much. I'm already backed up, you know, 8 months to try and get my services done. Talking to homeowners who were saying, I can get someone to do the work for $25 an hour, but the person who can really do it is making $40 an hour, and it's not, I can't get on their schedule. So we went into an agreement with out of Albany, out of our local community college, Hudson Valley Community College, and their Workforce Development Institute, to develop a series of courses in the traditional trades. And we began with windows because we really did see that windows were the highest need and also one of the most divisive issues, particularly in historic districts across New York State, where replacing windows in a historic district is part of code. You cannot do it. You must repair the windows. Those are the rules when you buy a home in a historic district. And these were the people who had the longest waiting list. So we launched our first class 2 weeks ago. We filled capacity. We have a waiting list of people who didn't get in. We keep the class small. we're in development for masonry, which comes up next. Now we're talking with Landmark Society, because the only way that I can make this a true statewide program in traditional trades is if I have amazing local partners who can help me push this out there, help me find who's the best instructor, help me find how do we get this funded. It's not something certainly that we could underwrite, you know, every time trying to develop these programs. So we're pretty confident and thrilled about this. We worked well with a group in Albany called the Historic Albany Foundation, who have probably what would be like Amy's dream. It's an architectural parts warehouse that has more wood sashes than you've ever seen, probably thousands. And we actually get to pull right from their inventory. And we teach them the very practical skills of removing lead how to set up a business model in terms of how does preservation work? What does it mean to present to an architectural review board or a preservation board? So it was more than just doing the work. It was making sure that we could give them enough and some basic skills that they could go out and then work on that business development model.
But as Dan is talking about, if you just kind of caught part of it, the development training that he's talking about is happening through the Hudson Valley Community College Workforce Development Institute. What would it take, realistically, for this kind of program to have opportunities in community colleges here in Rochester, Buffalo, Syracuse, all over the state?
Well, there's two things to think about. Is there an accredited degree program? That would be a dream. It would be wonderful if you could have a discipline within a construction technology program where somebody could incorporate this into a degree program. Then there's certificate-based programs, which are easier to develop. So you could approach either two aspects of that. Caitlin and I have talked pretty extensively of, well, how do we want to do this? Do we want to go through workforce development? Or maybe there's other opportunities and other stakeholders where, given the State Historic Preservation Office's name, the Landmark Society's name, we can create sort of our own certificate program. So I think the model changes based on the need. In the Hudson Valley, we have an interested member who is dying to bring this to a BOCES program. She only envisions this particularly for very young students to come work on the mass amount of Hudson Valley. So I could see it taking different approaches in each region.
Okay. Caitlin and Wayne, you want to weigh in on what you think could happen then?
Yeah, I think, you know, it could take many different forms, like Dan was saying. I mean, there's lots of homeowners here in Rochester who do their own windows or want to do their own windows and like developing those skills as they're rehabbing their houses. They want to, you know, get hands on, get their hands dirty and do it themselves. So, you know, you could approach it that way and try and just educate as many people as possible. And it might not be for them, it might not necessarily be a career. Or you could take more of an academic approach where you're really developing that workforce. Mm-hmm. And I think both are really valuable. I mean, both help, you know, spread the gospel. but yeah, we'll have to see what kind of sticks and what works locally and what kind of partners we can get together.
Okay.
Yeah, our students for our first class, we had about four homeowners. We had a husband and wife team. They want to do all of their windows. Then we have people who are saying, I'm really being pushed because my mother says I can get more work in our historic district if I take this course. She's telling me to take it. So it was a real combination of people who actually enrolled.
Okay. And Wayne, you want to jump in there too?
You know, when we listed this topic on our 5 to Revive this year, the response was...
Last year now.
Yeah. The response was just overwhelming. We knew it was a hot button topic, but I don't think anyone really on our staff or our board really knew just how hot button it would be. We've been trying to approach it over this past year, the issue that is of trying to merge the traditional trades, and of course that would include windows, masonry, roofing. There's so many different areas that one could really pursue. And we've been trying to merge those professions in with some of the already existing efforts here in Rochester to align with the anti-poverty initiative. So we have all these people who are having a difficult time finding a job in a city that has lost manufacturing positions. And we really view that this is an incredible potential. I was speaking with... obviously, we talk about, and we always advocate, you know, saving the window, making sure that if the window is not just completely deteriorated, that one should really work to preserve that window. Even in the case where windows don't exist and a new wood window has to be fabricated, Caitlin and I had talked about this. Rochester Colonial has a division called Heartwood Windows. And you go into their shop, and it's very sort of micro. They hire skilled craftsmen who construct these new windows very, very specifically out of wood. They're not able to find the skilled carpentry laborers to fill their open slots. So it's a problem that we see that's just widespread. And so this next year, we're looking at the possibility of doing much of what Dan is discussing, which is offering these workshop programs. It's just a matter of how to really approach that.
Sounds like there's a lot of demand for it. Caitlin?
And I know that there's people out there that are interested in pursuing this as a career, because after we did the Five to Revive announcement, you know, my phone's ringing off the hook with, oh, I heard, you know, the traditional trades, Five to Revive. So where can I go to sign up to you know, pursue this as a career? And I just have to say, we're working on it, you know? Yeah. I don't have an answer for you right now.
I get job applicants from all over the country in Canada that say, you know, this is where I say it can't just be a business model for building, like, small-time entrepreneurial, like, you know, companies. Some people just want to work for someone. They want a paycheck, and they right. want stability, and they want benefits, mm-hmm. you know? And so, like, that's also an important side to this, too, is, you know, how do we work to provide those opportunities as well?
All right, I'm late for our early break of the hour, and we're going to come back to your phone calls. Paul in Seneca County, hang there. If you want to call the program and join the conversation as we talk about the revival of the traditional trades, particularly as it relates to preservation, you can call the program 844-295-TALK, toll-free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI for calling from Rochester, 263-9994. We'll come right back to your phone calls. I'm Evan Dawson. Friday on the Next Connections, first hour. It's the first in our series of interviews with a dozen candidates for Rochester City Council. We'll take them three at a time, and you'll have a chance to hear their views on how they want to make the city a better place and why they're asking for your vote. Then in our second hour, it's a preview of the upcoming One Take Film Festival at the Little. We'll talk to some directors about their films. It's all coming up Friday. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Paul in Seneca County, first up on the phones. Go ahead, Paul.
Hi. How are you?
Good. Very good. Thanks for calling. Go ahead.
I really enjoy your program. But I'm in a rural part of Seneca County, and I'm a retired contractor, cabinet maker, and the main area of my work was in Ithaca, New York, and I think it has a reputation for having more carpenters with college degrees than any other place in the region, just because you get a degree and then you don't really have a way to make a living, and you end up being going into the trades and hopefully making a decent living, but not always. And part of that, I think, my main point here is that we have to get trade unions into the carpentry profession. Got them for plumbing, electrical, most other trades have some kind of unionized system that helps establish standards. And these days, if you go out and hire a carpenter to do something, you have no idea about the quality of work you're going to have, except by reputation, which you know, you have to count on. There's no reason, and that would also help with the issue of stature for the trades, to just have a standardization of skill level and income level would get boosted that way also. So that's my comment, and I'll listen to you off the air.
Paul, thanks for the kind words, and thanks for the phone call. Amy, what do you make of what Paul had to say there?
One of my guys that works for us used to be a union organizer in Chicago. So we've talked actually quite a bit about, how this trade in windows in particular fits into a union model. And the thing is, there's nowhere for it to really plug into, because we have painting and glazing that we do. There's carpentry that we do. We're on site. We're in a shop. I mean, it's a very complex trade, and so what it because it overlaps many unions. This is my understanding and how it was described to me, so I might be wrong. But my understanding is that because it overlaps, that it would be very difficult to be sponsored by an umbrella union, and that we need to create our own union. So, which is incredibly, takes a lot of work to do that. So the way that I look at it is, I'm working really hard in developing this business to create jobs that are good, and to, unions are necessary in many ways, because there were health and safety standards that were not being met, and that there were, you know, issues of compensation. I think that if you develop your business such that you are, your goal is to take care of your workers and to create good jobs that have benefits, and that, you know, and you structure it in the correct way, and are responsive to their feedback, then I don't think that it's a necessary thing in pursuing, you know, reviving this trade. You know, I don't know. It's not something that.
Well, and here's Richard on Twitter on the same kind of subject. He says, and again, I'm not the expert on pay rates here, but Richard says pay rates for skilled trades have eroded to a point where they are unattractive career choices for many. Do you disagree with that?
I mean, right now I'm not paying where I would like to pay. That's because we're in a startup grind, and that's just sort of indicative of startup business and the phase that we're in. So I would say that, you know, it's a goal of ours. I don't know how to, you know, answer it because...
Sure, but more broadly speaking, do you think that we're moving in a direction where we're going to see pay rates improve, that this will be an attractive career choice?
I mean, they go through booms and busts just like construction itself and development itself goes through booms and busts. So, I mean, in any profession, there's a lot of variability in it. You know, as an architect, you can make next to nothing, or you can work, you know, you could be well paid. So I think there's a lot of, I wasn't trained in this area, so mm-hmm. I'm also okay. Without some background.
Yeah, Dan.
You know, one thing is, I think there's a difference in our comprehensive plan in looking at this. We saw higher demands and higher wages in cities, and we saw less demand and wages in rural areas. It wasn't happening, and certainly it's not happening in the suburbs. But where the cities tend to have more of...
It's not happening in Henrietta, is it?
Nope. When cities enact more preservation laws within their communities and they create more historic districts, they were creating more demand through that by actually preserving their historic building stock. And there was where we were seeing people who were making more per hour, whether it was, you know, a five-person shop or the one-person shop. Mm-hmm. But it depended a little bit. And I don't think if a municipality doesn't embrace preservation, then you're not embracing growing that trade.
I think that also, you know, encouraging larger businesses to be able to develop. That, I mean, that's what gives you an hourly wage, right? Is mm-hmm. a job. So when you're talking about hourly wages, that requires that, you know, there are jobs for people to take. So you know, I think that when you look at you know, people that do struggle in the trades tend to be, you know, people that work as subcontractors. I think that the construction industry, it does a really terrible job of enforcing, you know, the 1099 versus W-2. If you're training anybody to do anything, they're not a 1099. And one of the bigger business challenges that we've gone through is that, you know, in understanding those employment laws, I train all of my employees. So they have to be employees. And that carries an incredible amount of overhead and just challenges in developing. Being able to offer livable wages on top of this overhead that now is being taken on, and to still try to remain competitive. I can't, my prices are relatively fixed if I'm looking at what a replacement window is going to cost and truly pricing in that manner. So I can't just charge whatever I want. I think a lot of, you know, onesie twosies, smaller operations do charge whatever they'd like, mm-hmm. because they know that those people have to keep their windows and they've got a nice queue lined up. And so, you know, I got into this trade because I'm driven by solution finding. And so I am, you know, probably stupidly taking on what is a very challenging topic, and kind of stumbling through it and learning and adjusting. And, you know, so I think in terms of livable wages, yeah, there's a lot of shifty business in the construction trades. That's not what we're about. And we're really looking to provide not only better service to our clients, but also better jobs to our employees.
I'm going to get back to your phone calls. It's the 2017 New York Statewide Preservation Conference. It's happening in Rochester over the next few days. We're talking a lot about the traditional trades, and especially in the context of preservation. And let's go to Henrietta. This is Caitlin in Henrietta. Caitlin Mivas is never in Henrietta. This is a different Caitlin. Go ahead, Caitlin.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I was just wondering, the workshop that you were talking about, I have an interest in art preservation and conservation. And I was wondering if the skills learned there are something that I could apply to that, because I've been having a hard time looking for workshops and classes in that.
So art preservation is what you're talking about.
Yeah, which is more typically called conservation.
Preservation of furniture or picture frames.
Yeah, of course. I think any kind of general carpentry course, strongly encourage you to take a general masonry course. Course, you can definitely apply that, because there are, and to use the word unique, this is a particularly unique skill, and doing and applying things related to the rehabilitation of any historic material, art or whether it's a wood sash, done incorrectly is only going to damage it. So it's part conservation, part rehabilitation.
Thank you.
Caitlin, thanks for the phone call. On Twitter, a dad has a question on behalf of his 7-year-old daughter, Jessica. So here's what 7-year-old Jessica wants to know. Why aren't more women depicted in the trades on TV?
I wish they were. I mean, I think that we're in a really interesting cultural moment. When I was, I'm in my 30s, and, you know, when I was a little girl, there certainly wasn't anybody. If you think about Tim the Tool Man Taylor, women that, you know, the women that were depicted on that show was Heidi, the showgirl, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, that is the traditional, if there was a woman depicted in construction, it was either a very, you know, large, like, you know, woman, very stereotypical construction gal, or this kind of sexy, floaty showgirl, you know. And I think that it is shifting. I mean, we do have some women on DIY, you know, network TV shows that are, you know, doing this work, but there should be more. And I think that it's the responsibility of the media to, or the, you know, these networks to be like cognizant of how they're displaying women or how they're promoting women. If you look at a lot of the couple, like husband wife duo programs, I've been solicited a few times about TV talks or whatever, mm-hmm. and the question is always, oh, do you have a partner? Do you have a man that helps you? Like, do you, you know, because they think, I mean, that's what sells, right?
Yeah.
And so I think that it's silly to think that that America can't handle a woman that is able to just be a strong woman that runs a business and that knows her skills. And
right.
You know, I think that that's something that we definitely need to see more of. I think that it's a larger cultural discussion, and I think that we are having good conversations as a country now. I think through some of the turmoil that we've experienced politically in the last year or so, there's been at least more discussions brought to the surface about gender and identity, and that you can be a girl and you can be feminine, but you can chase frogs in the creek, and you can still you can do whatever you put your mind to it, and are capable of chasing your dream. So there should be more, and I hope to be a good example, basically.
Yeah, I don't think 7-year-old Jessica needs me to say that she can do whatever she wants, and she's going to. It sounds like she's going to be awesome.
Have her reach out to me.
So if you're listening, Dad, if Jessica wants to reach out to Amy Swift, who is the owner of Building Hugger, who's building this really remarkable business in Detroit, but in Rochester. Easiest way to get a hold of you? You want to jump on your website? Building
Our website's down. Facebook or Instagram right now.
Facebook or Instagram, Building Hugger. You can find Amy Swift there. And so there you go. But before we lose the hour, I also want to mention that with this new presidential administration, there are different priorities. There's always different priorities when there's a new White House and a new party in charge of the White House. And one of the things that I think the preservation community is focused on is what could happen to tax credits and ways that preservation is being supported federally. So there's different things that are helping preservation, helping some of these efforts. And I would love for our guests to kind of get us up to speed on what's going on. I think Wayne, Dan, Caitlin can help us with that. So Wayne?
Yeah, sure. So in the preservation community, there's really one major tool that we utilize daily to preserve historic buildings that are a significant part of our heritage, and at the same time create jobs and create catalysts for economic development, and that is this Historic Rehabilitation Tax Credit Program. And there's a federal tax credit, which is a 20% credit, and there is also a joining, I guess you could call it, state tax credit, which is a 20% credit. So it doesn't take a mathematician to put those two together and to realize that on some of these projects that are really expensive, this tax credit is what really provides the basis for moving the project forward. And a quick example, we were Sibley's department store. That building is our conference headquarters. And Wind Development out of Boston is developing that project. That's a $200 million project. It's just massive, and it's such an iconic building. Without those tax credits, that project just simply doesn't happen. Now, there's always the argument about you have state and federal subsidies going to these projects, but my counterargument, and I think my colleague's counterargument would be that do nothing is not an option. And if we do nothing and these buildings are just left to languish, eventually there are problems that we have to deal with. And by dealing with that, it almost always means looking at local, state, and federal dollars to demolish it and clean the site up. And so this is preventative maintenance, and it's one of the few federal programs that actually turns a profit for the federal government, and logic says that we should advocate to maintain it. And certainly the Landmark Society and I know some colleagues around this state are certainly in support of that.
Is your math pretty trustable when you say it turns a profit for the federal government?
Well, I think that certainly if you look at the metrics, I think that it's without a doubt.
Because there's a ripple effect. So when you bring a building back online, it's now paying local taxes. There's going to be businesses in there. And so it has this ripple effect on the local community and on the state and federal government. So the money that's coming out is being more than repaid for. And there are, Wayne's not just making that up. There are economic impact studies.
I make up some other stuff, but not that.
I'm not accusing you of making it up. I just had a job to push you a little.
You know, I think that too, if you look at just when you compare it just with the absolute basement level of demolition and cleanup costs, it's a drop in the bucket.
But it could be gone, right? I mean, we could.
I think we're facing the very real possibility that it could be gone. And If it's gone, certainly from a long-term perspective, there are some real problems. Not just from a preservation standpoint, there are some real problems that communities all across the nation will have in trying to find new uses for what we call these zombie properties. And certainly in Rochester, we have enough vacancy problems as it is.
Okay, and what about on the state level? Is there any way for the state to fill any sort of the gap if it's caused by federal drops in subsidy or an elimination?
Well, we're watching it very closely. We do go to Washington. I'm fortunate to go down there and get to speak to our representatives about the importance of this program and the Historic Preservation Fund that keeps the SHPOs going and sort of our engine for preservation working with our colleagues. We look at it very closely. If through tax reform, we were to lose this program, our current legislation is not designed to survive without it. You must receive the federal historic tax credit in order to be considered for the New York State credit. So I'm sure there would be very serious discussions about looking at our bill and seeing if we could propose or work with the governor's office to look at something different. But we're very focused on making sure that we have enough bipartisan support within New York State to send a message that this has made an enormous difference.
Yeah, I have been really measured on this microphone in voicing my own concerns about federal funding for, I don't know, things like the arts, public broadcasting. You're going to hear more, I'm sure. But all I would say, and this is not to lecture or be on a soapbox, is if anybody tells you in any future election, the choices are exactly the same, the outcomes will be the same, your vote doesn't matter, think about priorities. Think about what gets funded. Think about what matters to you. And then in this moment, remind them, anyone telling you that, it's not true. So the preservation community is thinking about that. That's something to follow as we go throughout the year. Budgets don't get decided overnight. We'll see. But some Wayne, some final thoughts from you as you go into the 2017 New York Statewide Preservation Conference, which I think is sold out, right?
It is. It is. And it's I think we broke an attendance record for the sixth straight year, which is fantastic. We have wonderful partners that we're appreciative of. And I think just moving ahead, we're looking at, again, preservation as it relates to economic development and this traditional trades topic, and trying to incorporate that more and more next year.
Well, thanks for coming in. Really always appreciate the conversation. And Amy Swift, who is the owner of Building Hugger, really fascinating story. I think we learned a lot from you. Good luck to you.
Thank you.
And thanks for coming in and sharing it.
Thanks for having me.
And inspiring not only us, but people like Jessica and her dad and all the people who are learning from the work that you do. So Amy Swift from Building Hugger, from the Landmark Society of Western New York, Wayne Goodman and Caitlin Mivas. Thanks, guys.
Thanks.
And our thanks to Dan McEnany, who's Public Outreach Coordinator for the New York State Division of Historic Preservation, which is still a thing right now. Still a thing. And we're glad it's still a thing.
It's not going anywhere.
It's not going anywhere. Thank you, Dan. Really appreciate it. That. Our thanks to Rob Braden, the engineer, and Megan Max, the producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Hope you have a nice afternoon, and we'll talk to you Friday on member-supported Public Radio.